You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff, and this is edition 327. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with academic and author Miguel Tinker Salas, who speaks about the dynamics and context of the left in Latin America. I recorded this conversation in the context of the rise of U.S. interventionism and imperial dynamics today under the Trump administration in the U.S., looking at the attack on Venezuela. But importantly, I wanted to talk to Miguel to really get a bit of a historical arc to understand how what has happened in Venezuela is connected to a history of U.S. interventionism in Latin America, going back to the Monroe Doctrine, but also not understanding the recent actions of the Trump administration in isolation from recent previous U.S. administrations, going back to points like the involvement of the Obama administration in the silencing of popular movements in Honduras against a coup d'etat by the right during that administration when Clinton was Secretary of State. And that's just one example of many to sort of try to understand this historical arc to what is happening now. And Miguel, I think, also offers some very important insights to understand the dynamics of left organizing in Latin America today, but also over the last 20 years, and to really, I think, share a meaningful perspective to understand a more nuanced and rooted analysis about thinking through the Latin American left in different dynamics in different countries. It's a broad and very different experience across geographies in the Americas, but I do think that Miguel in this conversation makes some very important points that are not heard often in broadcasts speaking about recent activities in Latin America of the U.S. administration under Trump. So here is my discussion with Miguel Salas on Latin America and the left for this edition of Free City Radio.
In the last months, there's been a lot of referencing to U.S. policy in the Americas as in, you know, the last year under the Trump administration, going back to this framework of the Monroe Doctrine and sort of looking at recent actions sort of as tied to a more historical approach of U.S. imperialism or U.S. quest for territorial and economic dominance in the Americas. Miguel, I think you probably could offer a more nuanced and layered understanding as to the ways what has happened recently is not happening in a vacuum, you know, and I think this is probably important for people to understand and to think about how, of course, there's a marked shift, you know, towards overt interventionism on the part of the U.S. administration. But if we look to, you know, sustained policy across different U.S. administrations, there is a continuity in some regards. Of course, distinction's important. You know, and I'd also like to talk to you about the sort of Latin American left, maybe a little bit later in the conversation. But Miguel, maybe you could just first introduce yourself and share a bit on this point about sort of understanding what's recently been happening within a continuity. Thank you.
Miguel Tinker Salas, Professor Emeritus at Pomona College in History and Latin American Studies. I think the commonalities are the U.S. exercise of empire, the exercise of empire, particularly in the context of incursions by China in Latin America. China is probably the leading economic partner for most of South America, so that Trump has been trying to displace, would like to displace China from that role. And if we go back to Laura Richardson, who was the Southcom commander She traveled through Latin America in November and last year, and concluded by saying Latin America is beautifully rich in minerals, oil, gold, water, subsequently all the issues, all the commodities the U.S. would want. And she was very clear about it. And I think we should believe her. She was very clear about wanting to displace China, wanting to extend U.S. influence, not just in the Caribbean and Central America, but throughout the region. And we saw a hint of that with Ecuador in last week, when the U.S. military operation combined with Ecuador to carry out a mission supposedly against the Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guard, which made no sense whatsoever. Again, the pretext is the war in Iran, and the context is Ecuador trying to, a president who is weak, trying to buttress his position or his role in his own country by purportedly taking a position in support of the U.S. And we also should think of it in the context of the Shield of the Americas, or what I call the Coalition of the Willing, which took place last week at Doral Beach Hotel in Florida, where Trump convened 13 conservative leaders of Latin America with the intent of fighting against drug trafficking, fighting against immigration. We used to say, the U.S. used to say, we're fighting for human rights. They used to say, we're fighting for environment. We're fighting for democracy. Those have all been discarded. Now it's very clear what the U.S. intent is. And these individuals have now signed on to a Shield of the Americas, whose purpose and goal is to stop drug trafficking and immigration. But again, why drug trafficking? Drug trafficking has a multifaceted aspect here. It's become the new weapons of mass destruction for the U.S. So whenever they want to attack somebody, Maduro in the case of Venezuela, well, he was a drug trafficker without any evidence. The number of boats, speedboats in the Caribbean that have been blown up and people killed, well, they were drug traffickers without any evidence. So again, we have a new mantra now, which is weapons, essentially as drugs, as the weapons of mass destruction. And in that context, it becomes a tool for U.S. empire. I should say very clearly that drug trafficking is the result of many ways of the neoliberal economic policies that were adopted in Latin America that displaced literally millions of people, workers, from the land, from their jobs. And there's a flip side of that, is the same thing happened in the U.S. Workers who were displaced in the Rust Belt, workers that were displaced from factories, then unfortunately may have turned to drugs. So there's a factor there that links both what's happening in Latin America and links what's happening in the U.S. and probably other developed countries as well. Because again, it's a public health issue. It's not a drug issue. It was going to be resolved militarily. It is a public health issue, as long as we understand the context is neoliberal economic policies. So to wrap up, yes, we're looking at the rise of empire, but I think it's a weak empire. I think it's a debilitated empire that now relies primarily on military might rather than soft power, or rather than economic power. It is, the Trump administration has turned the military into its principal fomenter of foreign policy. And it's such an easy thing to do because the military is very effective. It can kidnap presidents, but it doesn't have a plan for the next day. It doesn't have a plan for what happens the next day. We saw that in Venezuela, we see that in Iran, and we've seen that wherever the U.S. invades or takes part militarily.
Miguel, thanks for going over those points. I wanted to circle back. There's a number of points to address there, but I wanted to circle back to the open discussion of U.S. governmental interests, but also corporate interests in accessing the land, essentially, and resources in different regions of Latin America. And I think that can maybe relate to a second point that I would love to hear your thoughts about, which is the sort of left in Latin America. You talked about neoliberal policies. You know, in different contexts, there's been this very vivid tension between social movements and center-left governments in Latin America. We can see that in Mexico, to some degree. Of course, in Brazil, that's a very important dynamic, not under Bolsonaro, but under the Workers' Party. But at least there's an actual, somewhat of a political process there in terms of there being a dialogue between local social movements and governmental power, let's say in Brazil or previously in Ecuador, not under the current administration. Whereas the U.S., it's clear that it's really just about power assertion and resource access. Whether or not that's successful is another question. But I'd love to hear some thoughts about this point from you. Thank you.
I think you're correct in pointing out the fact that the U.S. wants commodities from Latin America. Their policies have always been driven by access to commodity and to markets. So they 60% of the world's lithium is in the lithium triangle in South America. The world's largest deposit of oil is in Venezuela. South America has 30 to 40% of the world's fresh water supplies. There's gold, minerals, copper. Those are all factors which drive U.S. policy. Just look at Venezuela. We'll give you an example. They kidnapped the president. Since the kidnapping of Maduro, we've seen the Secretary of Energy Wright visit Venezuela and make sure that oil was accessible. We've seen the Minister of the Interior, and his interest was in signing contracts for gold and gold extraction, no concern for the environment or for indigenous people. We've seen the head of the CIA visit Venezuela. We've seen the head of the Southcom, Donovan, General Donovan, visit Venezuela. So they're now treating Venezuela as their backyard patio. As long as they have access to the mineral wealth, they seem to be not concerned with the fact that they really haven't affected regime change. What they affected was kidnapping, a decapitation of a particular leader at one particular moment in time. The social movement question is much more complex because there is a symbiotic relationship, at least in some countries, where those movements gave legitimacy to the government and the government gave legitimacy to those social movements. And that was very important in understanding that the movements existed independently, but they also were a factor in providing legitimacy to governments who proclaimed to be leftist and who needed then the legitimacy of the social movements in order to be able to clarify their position. So in that sense, some governments saw social movements as a nuisance in many cases, and they left them to one side. And the real issue here is how do those social movements integrate? How do they maintain an autonomy? How do they maintain their position? How are they able to leverage government support while not being co-opted by the government? So again, those are some of the factors to consider, particularly since the political movement on the right has increased dramatically. If we look back, the pink tide is receded significantly in Latin America. You look at Argentina, you have Milei. You look at Chile, you have Cast. You look at Ecuador, you have Noboa. You look at Brazil with elections coming up against Lula and Bolsonaro, son Bolsonaro. And according to the last poll, they're almost tied now for the election. So again, we have seen where the left tide has receded, and instead the right wing has come to power. Why are they coming to power? Because the left wasn't able to deal with the social inequalities. The left wasn't able to deal with the economic model. The left has to develop a position on what to do about crime. Bukele has an offer, arrest 5% of all male people and throw them in jail. That's his solution. So again, the left needs to, one of the lessons I would take away from all this is the need to look back and examine the last 20 years to see what models have worked, to see what models have not worked, and to be able to come forward with something different, because the left has to renew its position in Latin America, as it does elsewhere, and have a different approach to crime, to the economy, to the environment, to social movements.
Those are great points. I very much appreciate also you bringing up their the cross-border dynamics, not just in Latin America, but also beyond. I'd love to hear a bit more of the thoughts. I'd love to hear a bit more of your thoughts about that relationship you described, a symbiotic relationship, sometimes a relationship of tension between social movements and left governments. But the reason I ask you about this, and I do definitely appreciate your point about the changing political dynamics in Latin America, but I think that if we're talking about, let's say, a progressive understanding of what's happened in Latin America in the last 20 years, internationally, let's say in G7 countries like Canada, there's, I'd say, I've heard pretty dominantly two positions. One is a very overt, unnuanced romanticization of left governments. And then the other position is just a total dismissal of that process that you are sort of pointing to. Of course, each context is different, but I'll just leave it there if you have any thoughts about why understanding that dynamic is important.
Well, I think the dynamic, we have to go back to the 1990s and remember that neoliberalism was on the front burner in country after country after country. They were imposing draconian structural adjustment policies. They were imposing austerity measures. They were cozying up to the U.S., they had a view of a unipolar world where the U.S. dominated, and for the majority of the population, this was a strategy for disaster. The economy was depleted, the resources were being taken abroad, and most countries and most parties on the right were becoming debilitated. They had exhausted their approach, their project. And that's the opening that the lefts had. So when you look at a country like Venezuela, where I spend most of my time studying, you had a country that had a model democracy, according to the U.S., a pacted democracy that began in 1958, a pacted democracy that excluded the left, excluded the military, and would not question the election would question the election of a leftist. So you had a model democracy that ran its course, and by 1989 was in crisis, by 1992 was facing a coup by Chavez and by others. So that kind of model we saw throughout most of Latin America, and that is acceptance of the Washington Consensus, acceptance of the neoliberal model. But the population was beginning to see poverty rates go up. Gangs beginning to take control of cities. We saw drug trafficking. So all the factors that were fundamental in creating the rise of the left were shared by most Latin American countries, were shared by Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. Each country was different. Social movements were more advanced in a country like Brazil, where you had a PT movement for historically, and you also had a sin tierra, those without the land. In a country like Venezuela, social movements were maybe a bit weaker, and there was that much more of a top-down approach in some cases between those social movements and the government. But again, what gave rise to this was the model that had been in play for the last 20 years was spent. And the population turned for an alternative. When Chavez wins the election, he wins by 57%. It is a national movement. It is a national character in that sense. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
I would love to hear your thoughts about how this context is important to understand the dynamics currently, and then also just any insights you might want to share for people hearing this in different cities in Canada, around why, there's a shift that has happened, but locating that shift currently vis-a-vis U.S. policy, but vis-a-vis also the shift to the right, it's important to understand the sort of context that you are just talking about.
Well, I think the shift to the right is the result of the left's inability to understand that it has to really grapple with these issues in a popular, transparent form, and it has to incorporate all segments of society where possible, and it has to be able to lead and not become bureaucratized, authoritarian, corrupt, We look at cases like Venezuela and we see, and other countries, and we see that the fact that they haven't been able to deal with corruption, they haven't been able to deal with authoritarianism, they haven't been able to deal with some of the very factors that they were fighting against in the first place. So that's why I said that one of the lessons that needs to really be done is to look back over the last 25 years and to draw the lessons of what actually worked, what were the best case policies, what were the best case scenarios, knowing that every country is different, knowing that every country will approach this differently. But there is some valuable lessons there in that past. There is some valuable lessons in that history. And we're seeing them play out today in the U.S. We're seeing them in Minnesota, where people have fought back against ICE in ways that we have not seen before. We have seen it among the youth who have taken up the cause of Gaza and see the importance of defending against the genocide happening in Gaza. So I'm very hopeful when I see that these issues are taken up, and not just dependent on old folks to recollect that past, but we see the youth already having learned the lessons of that past. We see it in Minnesota. We see it in Los Angeles. We see it in New York. We see it in area after area where the U.S. is deployed. And the U.S. is trying to militarize its own cities. It's trying to normalize the military presence in cities the way that Latin America's elite did it before them. So in that sense, I think it's important to look at lessons both in so-called first world countries like the U.S. and also lessons in third world countries like Latin America.
The last point I would just ask you, Miguel, is just understanding how approaching this topic with nuance that you described is possible at the same time with being overtly opposed to U.S. interventionism. You talked about Venezuela. It's obvious. The pressure on Cuba. Holding those two things is possible, right? And I'd just love to hear any final thoughts about that.
Two things are very much possible. You can be critical and criticize left governments in Latin America and not be supportive of U.S. imperialism. The issue in Venezuela was not just Maduro. It wasn't about Maduro. It was about the country's sovereignty. It was about the country's right to self-determination. It was about the country's right not to be invaded by the U.S. So this was not just about Maduro. Maduro was the target. But the real issue was Venezuela. The real issue was, and why did they pick Venezuela? Because Maduro had separated himself from the population to some degree. He was in a weaker state, and therefore they knew that he was, as we say in Spanish, fruta baja, a low-level fruit. So in that sense, it was something that they could do. But I think it's critical to understand that we can be critical of the processes that we see in Latin America, but we stand for the right of self-determination, the right of sovereignty, the right of nations to dictate their own course of action, and the importance of people resolving their own internal affairs and not relying on foreign empire or foreign interests to do that for them. The lesson of U.S. and nation building is a disaster, no matter where it's at. So in this sense, it's critical and important that countries throughout the region unite, support each other. And right now, we have Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil, the three largest countries that are the targets of Trump administration, and of course Cuba, because of its weaknesses in terms of energy production, et cetera, is being squeezed in ways that we haven't seen before. But again, the crisis is throughout the region, and I think that the countries of Latin America have much to offer in terms of support for social movements.
That was a conversation with Miguel Tinker Salas, speaking about the left in Latin America. Miguel is the author of a number of books, including Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, published in 2015, and also The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela, published in 2009. Thank you so much to Miguel for being on the broadcast this week. Free City Radio airs weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Free City Radio is also a podcast. Look us up. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week. Thank you.
You're listening to CJ.